headlines this hour, UN human rights experts urge Canada and the Vatican to hold thorough investigations into the discovery of the mass grave at a former residential school. India reports nearly 3,400 new coronavirus fatalities in the past 24 hours, as its overall death toll tops 344,000. And Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei warns against enemy attempts to frustrate people and lower the voter turnout in the upcoming presidential election. Thanks for joining us. UN human rights experts have called on Canada and the Vatican to conduct a full-fledged investigation into the discovery of a mass grave at a former church-run residential school for Indigenous children. Nine experts urged an internal and judicial investigation into the circumstances and responsibilities surrounding the deaths. They said that perpetrators of such crimes should be sanctioned and prosecuted. The experts also called for similar investigations into Canada's other residential schools. That is while Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had earlier criticized the Catholic Church for ignoring its role in running many residential schools in his country. Last week, a mass grave containing the remains of 215 children were found in British Columbia. The school was operated by the Catholic Church on behalf of the Canadian government from 1890 to 1969. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says that the Canadian government and the Catholic Church have to run a UN monitored probe into the issue of recently discovered mass grave of Indigenous children.
Unfortunately, there's going to be no other, you know, mechanism like the UN to come in and to, you know, start a proper investigation. I think it has to be monitored, but the Canadian government has to, you know, come up, present the money and investigate. And at minimum, these schools have to turn over their records to the government or some sort of independent commission. And of course, the Catholic Church and any other church that was involved with these schools has to do the same thing. So it's a major exercise, but I think it's one that needs to be done.
India has registered more than 120,000 new cases of coronavirus infections, the lowest daily figure in almost 2 months. Such a daily tally has not been reported since April 7th, when the health system of the world's second most populous nation buckled under a record surge in COVID cases. The government has managed to flatten the curve of both new cases and deaths with regional restrictions, among other measures. The total infections now stand at about 28.70 million. India has also reported nearly 3,400 additional deaths over the past 24 hours. That has pushed the overall death toll closer to 350,000. Daily fatalities are still high compared to figures posted 2 months ago, when they hovered around 700. Munawar Zaman says the downward trend in India's COVID-19 cases is nothing to celebrate.
It is nothing to celebrate yet, because we're not just talking about the rising number of infections, and there is a slightest drop over the last few days. In fact, the cases are dropping significantly. But the death toll is the area of concern, because if we go by the government figures, then we can imagine what the death toll could be, actual death toll, because many reports and surveys have suggested that the death toll could be as much as 20 times what the government figures are saying. So there is nothing much to celebrate yet, and even the scientists and health experts have given some detailed reports and suggestions today that it is too early to say that the pandemic has started retreating, because we are expected to we are anticipating a third wave as early as September. So yes, of course, we will have to wait and watch what the next wave could be, because right now the country is still desperately struggling to deal with the second wave. And to some extent, it has been a disastrous few months for the country, and the government has been trying its hard to deal with the shortage of oxygens, shortage of vaccinations, shortage of hospital beds.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has warned against the enemy's attempts to create rifts between the Iranian people and the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah said that Khamenei was addressing the nation on the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of Islamic Republic's founder, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted the significance of elections in Iran. He stressed that Imam Khomeini viewed elections as a manifestation of people's will and stood firm against hegemony and corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also referred to the upcoming presidential vote. He said existing shortcomings should not discourage people from having political participation. The leader also recommended that people consider deeds rather than words of the presidential hopefuls and urged the candidates to avoid making hollow promises. He urged influential figures to encourage people to participate in the election. Iran's prime minister urges the U.S. to stop using economic war as leverage. Negotiations held to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the call in a telephone conversation with his British counterpart. He also stressed that Washington must fully return to its obligations under the nuclear accord, known as the JCPOA. Zarif said that he and British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab have agreed on the necessity of resuming full compliance with the nuclear deal. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran, prompting remedial commitment cuts from Tehran. Iran and the remaining signatories are now engaged in talks to revive the accord. Iran has repeatedly emphasized that Washington has to take the first step by removing all the sanctions in a verifiable manner. Political commentator Jason Unruha believes Iran's economic stability shows the U.S. pressure campaign on the country has been ineffective.
I think that the main barometer when understanding when the United States might give up in this regard is the level of economic development that Iran reaches. The whole goal of this is to undermine the Iranian economy. It's to undermine Iran as a regional power. So if Iran has a strong economy, then the goal or the tactic, what it is they want, isn't working. So I think that that's a really good way. I think that if Iran's economy were to suddenly decline very sharply or severely, that would be a sign of the U.S. to continue the pressure. But as it stands right now, Iran's not doing too bad. Obviously, suffering from the ill effects of COVID, just as every country in the world is right now. But I think that's going to be the main barometer is the right. Economic stability of Iran. I think that the historical precedent surviving U.S. pressure is certainly there, and it's not something that Iran is going to give up anytime soon. So I think that the genuine resistance to U.S. imperialism is always going to be with the Iranian people for the foreseeable future.
Israeli forces have injured nearly 300 Palestinians during anti-settlement protests in the north of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says 26 people were hit by live rounds in the villages of Beita and Beit Dajan, both near the city of Nablus. The Israeli military also reportedly used drones to disseminate poisonous gas during the protest. Palestinians were protesting against the construction of a new settlement outpost on top of the Spey Mountain. Israeli forces also injured at least 25 Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Also, Israeli forces attacked and dispersed people taking part in a marathon. The race was aimed at raising awareness about dozens of Palestinian families facing eviction in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhoods. For a second week, thousands of activists in northern England have protested outside of a major British arms factory, BAE Systems, condemning the firms for arms sales to Israel. The anger comes after weeks of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, including the killing of innocent children in Gaza. Rob Carter has more from the scene.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
Calls are mounting for the British Home Office to shut down a controversial barracks in Kent being used to accommodate hundreds of asylum seekers. Ahmed Caballo has more with this report from London.
Squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier military barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Linden agreed and said all of them were
vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they say, the guys say to me, some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
They felt they need to, they've been used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working, hence someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court will be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Allegations of institutional racism continue to haunt Britain's monarchy. A damning report by left-wing newspaper The Guardian on how Britain's royal officials banned ethnic minorities from clerical roles up until the 1960s, even as the country went through a youth-driven cultural revolution. That against the backdrop of racism allegations from some members of the royal family and denials from others. Saeed Puduza reports.
In a year not short of drama, the British royal family is embroiled in yet another scandal. Claims of historical racism. Unearthing documents in the UK National Archives, The Guardian has revealed palace officials banned, quote, colored immigrants or foreigners from serving in clerical roles in the royal household until at least the late 1960s. Instead, they were permitted to work as domestic servants.
In the optics of what the royal family has been about, I mean, just a knowledge of history, would tell you that it's a highly racialized institution. And regardless of the fact that the Queen runs a Commonwealth, which is a majority of minority ethnic background vis-a-vis the Brits, that would be black and so on, it doesn't surprise me at all.
The ban was eventually ended, but Buckingham Palace has refused to say when, only that its records show employment of ethnic minorities started in the 1990s and that it did not keep records on staff members' race from the decades prior. The archive documents also reveal Queen Elizabeth II has been exempt from race and gender equality laws since their introduction in the kingdom in the 1970s, prohibiting individuals working for her household from suing on discrimination grounds. That exception remains in place to this day.
What is happening is that across the world, people are taking a different view of the royal family. And as she is in charge of the Commonwealth, it does not bode well for the future of the Commonwealth at all.
The new findings come on the heels of allegations earlier this year of racism within the ranks of the royal family from two of its members.
And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
And of silence and denials from other members.
So we're very much not a racist family.
This week, the Queen will be marking a huge annual spectacle celebrating decades of her reign. Will the new revelations put a damper on the British monarch's so-called platinum jubilee? Saeedpour is up, London.
The White House press secretary has reacted to a decision by Facebook to extend a ban on former U.S. President Donald Trump until 2023.
I think as we look at it, we learned a lot from President Trump, the former president, over the last couple of years about his behavior and how he uses these platforms. It feels pretty unlikely that the zebra is going to change his stripes over the next 2 years. To crack down on false information.
Just like he said, social media companies have a responsibility to crack down on misinformation about issues including politics and vaccination. She made the comments after Facebook announced its updated policies, saying that it no longer allows politicians to spread false or abusive content on the platform. Trump was booted off social media after his followers stormed Capitol Hill on January 6th. He was accused of inciting violence after the deadly incident but survived an impeachment trial. He protested the result of the 2020 presidential election and still maintains that his votes were stolen by the Democrats. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
European officials have downplayed Israeli regime actions in recent days, says Martin Kanseni, journalist, in an article titled Europe's Shameful Bias on Israeli Regime. Stay tuned for more. As the Israeli regime assaulted against Palestinians erupted recently, European political statesmen lined up across a familiar spectrum. On one side were leaders in Central Europe, including Austria, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Slovenia, who expressed unreserved support for the regime of Israel and put all the blame on Hamas resistance movement. And on the other side, others positioned themselves in between, calling for de-escalation and protection of civilians. The overall tendency among European officials, however, has been to skew the chain of events in this latest escalation. They tend to omit or downplay the series of Israeli regime provocations in occupied East Al-Quds that preceded the Hamas rockets. These included the threat of eviction of Palestinian families by Israeli settlers and the storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli regime forces, which left some 300 Palestinians wounded. Then, they elevate the rockets into the single truly unjustifiable element. And finally, they again downplay the Israeli regime response in the form of airstrikes on Gaza, by far the deadliest part of the chain. No statesman clearly addressed the fundamental issue, the long-term denial of basic rights and freedoms to Palestinians under the decades-long Israeli regime occupation of the West Bank, the blockade of Gaza, and the ethno-territorial conquest, euphemistically known as settlement expansion in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds. This oppressive and unjust context makes the cynical explosions of violence near inevitable, and it should be addressed first and foremost. Selective perceptions are common in all nationalist conflicts, which tend to activate a cognitive bias that makes many people downplay the wrongdoings of their preferred side, that is, the fake regime of Israel. As such, nothing is surprising about Israeli narrative primarily blaming Palestinian rockets, while many Palestinians conversely consider them a justified response to the Israeli regime's overwhelming aggression. What is distinctive about this case is that a significant part of the Western political elite, for reasons including cultural affinity and historical sympathies, lean towards or fully side with the Israeli narrative. Anyone thinking that the European statesmen are reasonably balanced should imagine how Europe and the US would respond if the situation was reversed. For example, Palestinians occupying, settling, blockading and bombing Jewish Israeli enclaves from which Jewish armed groups then fired rockets towards Palestine. In such a scenario, the West would probably not only condemn the Palestinian oppressors but impose heavy sanctions and discuss no-fly zones. The double standard is also visible in the notion that the Israeli regime has the right to defend itself, as they say, present in several European communiques. None save other Palestinians who have no Iron Dome to protect them also have the right to defend themselves against Israeli regime attacks or any other consumerist right. Selective European statesmen are hard to square with assessments of the past rounds of Israeli regime assault against Palestinians by UN investigators, the International Criminal Court, ICC, and NGOs such as Human Rights Watch. These observers generally follow universal and impartial norms of international law and are generally trusted by the European political mainstream. All of these actors have found ample evidence of serious violations, probably amounting to war crimes. EU member states have frequently abstained in votes to launch UN investigations into Gaza violence at the UN Human Rights Council while voting in favor of investigations into other conflicts. Similarly, while the EU collectively supports the ICC as a pillar of the international rule of law, several European states opposed Palestine's accession to the court and the ICC's jurisdiction over it. This is not just inconsistent, but also contributes to the recurrent violence by giving the Israeli regime the impression that it can avoid international accountability. If they want to contribute to peace, European governments must end their favoritism and reorient their policies to address the injustices against Palestinians that are driving the cycle of violence.
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden has declared white supremacy the most lethal threat to his country on the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. During his visit to Tulsa, Oklahoma, Biden said the country needs to acknowledge its dark history of racial injustice and avoid silence about it as he joined a commemoration marking the Tulsa massacre. Biden is the first sitting U.S. president to do so 100 years after one of America's darkest episodes of deadly racial violence. The massacre took place in June 1921 when mobs of white supremacists who had been provoked by city officials attacked black residents in Tulsa's Greenwood District, burning down their businesses, destroying some 1,200 homes, and killing more than 300 African Americans. Our correspondent Colin Campbell is joining us now from Washington to tell us more about the reactions of the Tulsa massacre commemoration and the comments made by President Joe Biden.
Well, in the U.S. media, it's been playing out that the president has been sensitive to the issues that happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, more than 100 years ago. There were times where we saw the flames of racial division flare up throughout U.S. history, but the Tulsa race massacre was one of the biggest, most conflagrated cases where we had mass casualties because of racial division in the country. Now, there are numerous cases, obviously, but this one marks one of the largest and most rampant and well-known cases where you had white-led hatred against black people leading the reasons for the dozens of murders that happened within 48 hours during that time. Now, the president is one of the first presidents, the first president to visit Tulsa, Oklahoma, to commemorate the race massacre from 1921, and this is something that he remarked upon during his speech. During that time, you had a burgeoning black middle class, one that drew the jealousy of neighboring whites, and it was just a powder keg waiting to happen. And what happened on that day, allegedly, is a black young man bumped into or tripped and fell on a white woman. This white woman screamed. Her screams were misinterpreted as some type of act of aggression or violence, and the young man was locked up. During that time, the white mobs wanted to lynch him, which was customary for a lot of white lynch mobs during that time to lynch young black men or black men in general. And there were groups of black men who were trying to prevent that from happening. A gun went off, and then things just exploded from that point. And this was the first time for, to let your viewers know, that this was the first time that the U.S. dropped bombs on other Americans. So there were airplane campaigns dropping bombs on the Greenwood neighborhood within Tulsa, Oklahoma, to burn down black businesses and kill black people. There were those who were dragged from trucks, people who were praying were shot and killed, executioner style, others murdered and stabbed. So this was really a bloody moment in U.S. history.
All right, thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington. On tonight's debate, we also have peace advocate Graylin Hagler, who's also joining us from Washington. Mr. Hagler, welcome to the program. Well, the long-hidden story of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre is getting wide coverage on its 100th anniversary. Why is the harrowing truth of the Tulsa Massacre getting more attention now?
Well, it's getting more attention, I think, at this point, because we've come through a time of really racial upheaval in the last 4 or 5 years in the United States of America. And in some ways, there's an attempt to try to get on the record what has been denied politically over the last 4 years, but also over the last 102 years, you know, because we talk about Tulsa, but we fail very much to even acknowledge Red Summer of 1919 that preceded Tulsa, that involved massacres in cities all across the country where hundreds and probably thousands of people were killed, murdered, towns were wiped off the map, black hamlets, villages disappeared. Or we forget to talk about the coup d'etat that took place in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898 when the town council was assassinated and blacks were boxcarred out of North Carolina with the threat of life never to return. All of those types of things, that's a part of the history that we never, ever talk about and is never revealed. So it's about time that some things come to light, but see, clearly not enough has come to light.
Well, joining us now from New York, we also have human rights attorney with the December 12th movement, Mr. Roger Wareham. Mr. Wareham, welcome to the program. What's your reaction to Joe Biden's remarks, and why did it take 100 years for a sitting president to address and acknowledge what happened in Tulsa?
First, I only heard the latter part of his remarks, but they were exactly on point and were some of the same points that I was going to make. Because the United States is never really ready to confront its history, which is, from its inception, is rooted in violence. And there was a brother in the 1960s who was the head of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who at that time was known as H. Rap Brown and later known as Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin. And he made the statement that violence is as American as cherry pie. I would also refer the viewing audience to a statement by historian Robin Kelly, and let me just read it very, very briefly. He's talking about why is it that people keep saying that the Tulsa massacre, race massacre, has not been known. And he cites a number of examples to show that from the time it happened, there were reports about it, and over the last 40 years it happened. But the point he makes is that the issue has never been about not knowing. It is about a refusal to acknowledge genocidal, state-sanctioned racist violence in the United States, a refusal to recognize the existence of fascism in this country. This is not to say the violence is simply denied by the status quo. No, rather, it is disavowed by the white property and political classes and displaced onto quote-unquote ignorant white racist workers. This narrative obscures how the violence fomented and promoted by the press and business interests became a pretext to take the land, an attempted land grab that continued for decades after 1921. So that gives you the perspective on what this was about and why a sitting president has never acknowledged it. Most presidents don't acknowledge the very racist, violent nature of the United States in terms of its development and capitalism, of the expropriation of the indigenous people, of the genocide that was committed against them, of the enslavement of Africans, because it would expose the myth of this shining country on the hill or White House on the hill that they use to maintain the mythology of what of democracy in the United States. President Biden has been forced to acknowledge this because not only is this the 100th anniversary, but because of the year that's preceded this, from the murder of George Floyd and all the other murders that preceded it and followed it, and the response of the masses of people in the United States to take this to the streets to demand a reckoning. So there's certain things that he's got to do in order to maintain this myth of democracy and that this can be resolved short of reparations. And that's one of the issues that this country does not want to deal with, the issue of reparations.
Mr. Hagler, a big question many are asking is why is the Tulsa massacre still relevant today? I think events following the killing of George Floyd comes to mind. What do you think?
Well, it's the killing of George Floyd, but all the other folks that have been killed, all the other names that, as we even chant, say the name, the list is so long that you'll never finish saying the names. That's the issue. It has been a historical, pathological problem in the United States in terms of this genocide. But let me, I agree wholeheartedly with my fellow guests on this show in terms of what he is pointing out. But let me also say this, because most presidents don't even know about the history. And one of the things is that there's always a struggle over what narrative gets told, what history is told. And when you tell history, what you put into it and what you leave out of it. I was recently over with a church member whose wife had died, and I was talking to him, and he was born, I found out, in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I said, what about the coup d'etat of 1898? He says, what coup d'etat? And so I began to explain to him the history, and he said, I grew up there. I ain't hear nothing about that now. I'm angry. And that's the issue. Why you basically remove histories, because you want to condition people into a false narrative of this country, and therefore basically try to say to those who are aware and angry and upset and marching in the street that they're just simply malcontents, rather than people who are attuned to the actual history and narrative of the country, and therefore are responding in accord to change it, to reform it, to revolutionize it.
Mr. Wareham, Biden, he declared white supremacy the most lethal threat to his country and called for America to confront its long history of hatred and avoid silence about it. Intelligence agencies have recently reported that terrorism from white supremacy is currently the most lethal threat to America. Unpack that for us, and how can this deep-rooted trend change, if ever at all?
Well, the fact that he's been forced to admit something that's been true for, at least for black people, that has been true for our entire existence in this hemisphere, has been the threat of, not just the threat, but the implementation of white supremacy terrorist acts against us. That's what maintained us in our position of enslavement. Once again, I think it's the events which are now forcing people in power to acknowledge certain things. The question is not simply the acknowledgement or the admission. The question is, what is it that's going to be done about it? I think that it's important, as Reverend Hagland said, that this is coming out, and people are learning the issue. They're learning what's happening. It's always been there, but the question is, who creates the narrative? And now the victims are beginning to at least dictate the narrative. What we can expect is that President Biden is going to do as little as possible to ameliorate the situation. There's going to be a lot of pomp and circumstance. When he was elected, he made a statement, basically, I could not have been elected without the support of the black community, and I've got your back. But he was defining what I got your back is. for him, I got your back, is I'm going to appoint some black people to some positions that I decide who's going to be appointed where. Our organization took the position that I got your back has got to mean you issue an executive order that speaks to a $50 billion down payment on reparations that's directed towards health care, because in the first instance, that's something that affects all black people. We've got to begin to define the narrative. We've got to begin to expose the education. In the United States right now, there's certain Republican governors who are telling their educational systems that they cannot teach what's called critical race theory, which is looking at the history of the United States really with an X-ray and not just on the surface in terms of what has been the motivation for the type of acts that have happened and continue to happen. So I think that's the period that we're in now. And he's doing what he has to do to maintain calm with people who, as Mr. Hagler said, when that brother found out about the Wilmington coup that he didn't know about, he was mad. A lot of people are mad. A lot of people are angry. And so what President Biden is trying to do is to stem that anger and give the appearance of that there's going to be some progress made.
Mr. Hagler, while remembering the Tulsa massacre, Biden promised new steps to help communities of color. Are the solutions as big as the problems in the history that African Americans and communities of color are standing against at this point?
Well, the solutions are never going to really address it, because the solutions are always going to be a so-called political solution. And a political solution is always a solution that is built upon compromising with those who are enemies of people who are oppressed, of black people, of brown people. And so it is never, ever going to be enough. I mean, one of the battles that are taking place right now is particularly when black folks turned out to vote and voted Trump out of office, and is that you see all across the country these moves to now restrict voting to make sure that those who voted are not able to vote. And basically also the big lie, just think of the big lie that Trump says, I won the election because the folks that they had historically made sure could not vote voted. And therefore, those were illegitimate votes as far as the eyes of white supremacists are concerned. I mean, so we still have this whole history, this whole dynamic that exists in the country. Now, I got to also admit that I'm backing away from using the word white supremacy or white supremacist. And I'll tell you why. Because to form those words is to tacitly give approval to whites being superior, and they're not. I'm now referring to it in old faith, church, theological language as idolatry, white idolatry, that it is a narrative that is built upon giving white folks power, and it's time that we take back the narrative and turn it back around and expose it for what it is, because an idol only has the power that people give to it, only have the power that is built around its narrative, and therefore we don't accept idols. And sometimes people of color also can be white idolaters, as you see in Tim Scott, who has stood up and basically said that there was no racism in America, or Kamala Harris, who stood up and said the same thing the next day. That's white idolatry, that you're so afraid of telling the truth because you fear that this white devil is going to turn on you, that you basically buy into the myth and buy into the lie.
I think that's
Ms. Wareham, Tulsa survivors, you just earlier mentioned the issue of reparations. Now, Tulsa survivors have tried and failed in the past to bring cases against what happened in Greenwood, so the reparations have been hindered, mostly when courts stepped in to protect the interests of the state. But there's an X factor here. And I think that's the issue of popular opinion and the coverage now that the Tulsa massacre is getting. Do you think that popular opinion can play a big part in all of this?
I think that popular opinion can play an important role, because I don't think it's going to get resolved in the courts. Most of the reparations that have been awarded and I don't know if Mr. Hagler spoke around some of the examples, because reparations only becomes a problem when it's reparations to black people. The Roma and the Jews after World War II got reparations. The State of Israel got reparations. The Japanese Americans who were interned in concentration camps during World War II got reparations. But I think that it's popular opinion is very important. And I think to the extent popular opinion can force the politically elected representatives to provide for reparations, that's what's going to make it happen. It's not going to be, the courts are set up in a way to prevent it from happening, even though there's no statute of limitations on murder. It's part of the status quo that was responsible for maintaining the situation that happened in Greenwood and Rosewood and in Wilmington and all the examples Mr. Hagler gave. So I think popular opinion is very important. I think that's why programs such as these are very important, because it spreads the word to people to know what's happening. And I think the role of the international community is very important in terms of bringing that type of pressure on the United States, who likes to swing exercise its clout around the world by saying, we can tell you what to do because we have this great democracy. And the counter is, but what about Black Wall Street? What about Rosewood? What about Wilmington? What about Attica? What about Wounded Knee? And so I think it's invaluable. I think in the final analysis, it's the activities and motion of people in the streets that creates the pressure for there to be, at least to some extent, a resolution. I think Mr. Hagler said the United States is not prepared to really provide full reparations because it would revolutionize the entire situation in this country, the entire political economy.
All right, that's all the time we have for this debate. Allow me to thank my guests, human rights attorney with the December 12th movement, Mr. Roger Wareham, joining us from New York. Also thanks to peace advocate Graylin Hagler, speaking to us from Washington. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, man and its social growth. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. When human society came into existence, it did not assume a perfect form to make growth and improvement, also of spiritual matters and of everything connected with man, right? So this is like the world as we see it, or human society as we see it, is not something that was created perfect from the get-go. The expectation is that human beings together who form that society, they are going to take that society towards perfection. Yes, there is an individual level perfection, but then there's a social level perfection, right? Both of them are our responsibilities. Human society, like other human intellectual and spiritual matters, constantly moves towards perfection in step with his material and mental attainments. In fact, the peculiarity of man, that is, his gregarious nature, should not be considered an exception to his other peculiarities, so as to allow us to claim that it assumed a perfect form the moment it was created. Rather, it should be said that this quality, like all other human qualities which are related to the will, power, and science, has gradually attained perfection. The human society is slowly moving towards that perfection, hopefully with our contribution, with our positive contribution. And this is what the ideal state would be when we take this society, human society, towards those perfection and the models of perfection. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about man and its social growth. And before the break, we discussed the growth of a society, of a human society. So start looking at society as an individual who goes through different phases of growth. Now, this perfection is only going to be attained through us. This perfection is not something that the society was created with, right? So it's not an intrinsic property of the society. Instead, this property of perfection of the society depends on the people in that society. Now, reflection about the condition of humanity makes us realize that the earliest form of human society has been the family, which resulted from marriage. The basic factors in bringing about family living are the fact that a male cannot be himself, ensure reproduction and upbringing of children, and that marriage ensures a lasting relationship based on the natural physical necessity and compatibility of males and females. This in turn leads to, for instance, employment. That is, a human being engages another as a medium to meet his needs and dominates him and imposes his will upon him. This same employment gradually takes the form of the exercise of authority, thus creating the master of the house, for instance, the head of the family, chief of a clan, and leader of a nation. So keep in mind that, all these building blocks are those necessity requirements of a human society in order for it to flourish, in order for it to develop, in order for it to reach that ideal perfect state. This is where you and I come into the picture, and this is where we, inshallah, together strive to build a society that is closer, if not it has reached those ideals. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Reporters. The race for the top executive post in Iran rages on among the seven candidates who appear before reporters every day to outline their plans. Plans for a brighter future, stronger economy, and more opportunities for the youth. So journalists rarely ask contenders about what they have done in the past, but what they will do should they win the election.
The first move that my administration will focus on is to uproot poverty in the first year. If poverty is eliminated, our people will excel in culture and enlightenment.
I will pay special attention to the youth and their problems. Unemployment is now the first and foremost issue of our youth. As an economist, I believe that if we remove the uncertainty in our market, we can easily create jobs. Also, I will allow young experts to run at least 50% of my cabinet.
All of the candidates have so far spoken of problems that they blame on the incumbent government. Problems that range from inflation to unemployment. Some of the contenders find the root cause of these problems in the fact that outgoing President Rouhani has put all his eggs in the basket of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is now hanging by a thread.
Nobody can ignore the negative effects of the sanctions on our economy. But at the same time, we cannot reach out to our enemy and appeal to them to lift the sanctions. This method has not worked and will not work. We cannot pin hope on the lifting of sanctions to fix our economy. We should have relied on our own domestic capacities to have a resilient economy.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th. The Islamic Republic holds an average of one election each year since its establishment in 1979. Now candidates call on Iranians to turn up en masse for this year's election, as in the previous rounds, since high voter turnout is translated into a seal of approval for the legitimacy of the Islamic establishment. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-time Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement.